The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai. Now offering 5 years free servicing on every new 142 Hyundai. Ireland's fastest growing car brand.
And good Sunday morning to you. It's Brendan O'Carroll sitting in again today for Marion Finucane. She sadly missed. I wish she was here right now. Great lineup today. Some lovely things to talk about, and a nice panel. We start off with Minister for Communications, Energy and Natural Resources, Pat Rabbit, is here with us, as is Joe Duffy. Joe, you might remember, used to be a radio presenter at RTE, very well known. Terry Prone, communications, from her communications clinic, and is giving Joe some lessons as we speak. Gerald Keane, solicitor to the stars and beyond. And, of course, Mary Hannafin, Fianna Fáil councillor for Dunleary, Rathdown. So let's have a look at the papers. Anybody see anything particularly interesting?
Yeah, you're in trouble. You are in dead trouble with the Sunday Times. This is the oddest breakdown of coverage. I can honestly say that 99.9% of newspapers this morning think Brendan O'Carroll is fantastic. He is more ubiquitous than Miley Cyrus's tongue. You cannot get away from him.
From her twerk.
And it's all good. Except for the Sunday Times, which says that yesterday when Brendan O'Carroll lost the run of his generous self and committed, was it 30 or 31,000?
30,000.
30,000.
It actually won't be that much apparently, but 30,000 is what he estimated he would need.
Okay. To somebody who is starting a business. The Sunday Times says he being Brendan O'Carroll, really should have done due diligence first.
That's the thing. I looked straight into his eyes.
Diligence on every act of kindness, nobody would do an act of kindness anywhere in the world.
Basically, what the Sunday Times are saying is that Eddie Malloy is even in more debt than we thought he was yesterday when you were listening to him.
Yes.
And you decided to. And it's the one thing you know about radio, it's a very transparent medium. It happens on Liveline all the time. If people come on and they're in difficulties or whatever, I said it to somebody 2 weeks ago. Now, remember, when you start talking and when you start telling your story, people will hear. And so the Sunday Times have discovered that Eddie Malloy is even more in debt than he was. Now, it's a pity the way they portrayed it because they were tweeting last night. The editor was tweeting last night that they had some new information as if it was devastating or whatever. And especially given that one of the big things that comes up again and again, it came up yesterday in the discussion about the scenario and the upset that people are going through, is the shame that people embarrassment and the
upset. It's nice for me to have a microphone this morning to get it and a chance to apologise to Eddie, because my intention in helping Eddie was not, as it turned out this morning in the Times, to shame him any further. That wasn't my intention. My intention was, here was a man. The one thing that struck me about his story was that here was a man, like everybody else in that room, he had a story to tell, and it wasn't a pretty story, and he was under pressure. But the thing that struck me about him was that right at the bottom of the briefing on him was that he had an idea that he thought would work and would get him out of trouble. And it was a little bit of hope. He had it, you know, it's very, very difficult at the moment for people to be getting through the day, but to be getting through the day and holding out a bit of hope is even more difficult. And that's really what's going to get us out of this, is the hope of people. People's having a go. And I think he's a good bet. And if he's not sure, I'll just get on the line with the techman, I suppose, you know.
Yeah, well, I presume the other thing as well, Eddie is now in the public eye, but he was on the programme, he is now in the public eye. He will have to accept, and that's the only worry I would have. The man, as we heard yesterday, is very, very upset about his family, and as so many people are. But just to let him know, this is normal. This is the normal discourse. When you're in the public eye, you will be questioned, you will be queried, and all the Sunday Times did, and it is their job, I suppose. All they did was say, this man is even more in debt than he said he was yesterday. So be it. Eddie, get on with the idea. If the idea works 100%, it doesn't work. And climb up again.
The positive side of it is that right at this stage, Eddie, whatever that idea is, and he hasn't even told me yet, whatever it is, the nation is holding its breath to wait and see what it is. So we got a great launch yesterday of the new idea. So good luck with that. Phoenix, people who are working with Eddie, They're actually working to clear those debts. And do we have anybody? Do we have somebody from Phoenix on the line? We don't. But they're working to clear his debts. This Phoenix organisation. Do you know, Minister? Do you know anything about this Phoenix, the Phoenix project?
No, not very much. Nor about this story. I was in Cork working yesterday, unfortunately.
Which means you have no communications whatsoever once you're down there.
That's right. You're certainly not able to listen to Brendan O'Carroll. Whatever about other communication. So I'm not up to speed with the story. But I read this morning.
The Phoenix Project seems to be a group of volunteer professionals, in many cases, solicitors, etc., that are working with people who are in dire straits voluntarily. They no payment for it. And what struck me yesterday is the people we had in the studio yesterday, and they came from all different places, were all somehow in contact with the Phoenix Project and felt that but for the Phoenix Project, they wouldn't be standing on 2 feet. So it's something I'd like to look into. And I said this yesterday to Oisin Quinn. He, like myself, and like yourself, are members of the Labour Party. Is that not something that the government should be doing? Is it not something like that we should be setting up?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of programmes and measures there to help spawn new enterprise or keep enterprise alive. But I suppose the problem is that since the crash, so many small businesses have got into trouble or companies folded entirely. I mean, the scale of the collapse is something unprecedented that we've never experienced before. But I mean, both the Department of Jobs and my own department run programmes to assist in certain circumstances, both for micro-enterprises and typical SMEs. But I suspect that you're talking about a category of people who have got themselves into, relative to the size of their enterprise, into dire difficulties.
Well, I am in some respects talking about, but what I'm saying is, and it's an aspiration, and it's probably a false aspiration, but as somebody who believes in the Labour Party and believes in what we stand for, my target would be, as part of a government, that there would never be a necessity for a Phoenix Project. We will take that ball.
That's an ideal that I think, you know, we would all aspire to. But in a market economy where we had a combination of recession and collapse of the banking system, a combination that never happened before, it is inevitable that there are circumstances like you describe. And the notion that the Labour Party or any party can wave a magic wand and cause them all to come into health again, you know, is a slow process, a very slow process. And
let's say the Phoenix Project was set up by somebody in government. Why don't the government ask for help? Why don't they ask for volunteers to set up these projects, unpaid volunteers? We can't pay them.
And surely, in fairness, Ben, the Phoenix Project, David Hall, Jerry, but there's a whole list of people out there. Some of them are like, some of them are disliked, some of them the politicians like, some of them they detest. There is going to be, and thankfully, in one sense, and it's an awful catastrophe people have gone through in the last 7 years, there is going to be community supportive of parish groups, and especially around this area of economic collapse, the shame of it, I come back to this thing again, that there are going to be, thankfully, now it's unfortunate that it had to happen, but there are going to be groups like Phoenix, like David Hall, like the Irish Mortgage Holders, like the Land League, whatever they call themselves. Now, these groups are going to spring up and they are going to be supportive to people. That's on the micro level. On the macro level, you're talking about a much bigger issue, and that's a governmental. But there is, I mean, I think that's one of the strengths about
this. My only difficulty is that people will help each other. But they seem to be detached from what's going on. The groups themselves seem to be detached from government. I think it would be a lot better if these things were taken under the umbrella of some government initiative that would say, look, let's get these groups together and see where we can help them.
Yeah, well, I mean, can I just say that, Brendan, I come across this regularly, and there are many groups like Phoenix. I've come across Phoenix, and there are many people, as Joe says, I don't think the people I'm dealing with who are in trouble and difficulty want to be dealing with another quango or another semi-state body or another semi-state support group. They really want quick, practical advice on the ground to help them. Mm. And the people like the Phoenix group and people like David Hall are doing that, and they're doing a very, very good job. And I come across it on a daily basis, certainly weekly basis, if not a daily basis. So what I'm saying is these people need quick advice, they need straight talking, they need assistance, they need to share their problems. And these are the the groups are doing it. Another quango or another group of a body set up by a government is the last thing that one needs when you're dealing with day-to-day problems of banks and mortgages and debts. And I do think that the more these problems are shared with people in who are dealing with these banks every day and are dealing with these creditors every day, the greater the assistance is to the people who need the help.
Can I come in on that?
Because, please, Terry.
The noises that you're making, Brendan, I actually remember my father making way back in the 50s when we were in as bad times. He was at least as passionate a socialist as you are, and he got involved in the creation. He was one of the founders of the credit union movement in this country. Now, if at that stage government had reached out and put its arm around the credit union movement, it wouldn't have had 50 years of community involvement. It wouldn't have been the People's Bank, all the good things that it was. Now, let's be clear, today's Mail on Sunday has a major league attack on where it is now and the usual pictures of people on junkets and stuff like that. And it's an awful shame that it has got there. But I honestly disagree with you. I believe that the people have a capacity to organise nationally without involving political parties or a government, and that often it is, no offence to the two politicians here, but that it is often more trustworthy to people if it isn't directly involved with government.
And I said,
don't forget as well, Brendan, you know, that there are organisations in existence sponsored and created by the state, like, for example, the Money Advice Bureau Service, MABS, that does immensely good
work.
And I think Terry's point about the League of, about the credit union movement and its ethos, I had the privilege in 1996, I think it was, of legislating, bringing in the new Credit Union Act, on the basis of which the movement has grown and grown since then and has tremendous roots in the communities throughout the country. Now, you know, one or two of the bigger ones got into trouble because they overstretched themselves. One of the big arguments we had when I was putting that bill through Dáil Éireann was that there was a lobby to enable the credit union to lend money for housing. And we resisted that because that was the job at the time of the building societies at that time. But obviously some of the big ones, under one guise or another, started to make big loans that, whereas they may not be stated for housing purposes, they were used for housing purposes.
As deposits or as whatever.
And a couple of them have got into very big difficulty. And you've seen instances like Newbridge coming into the public domain and so on. But generally speaking, the credit union movement, for example, I think in the future, in league with An Post, has a capacity to establish a network, an infrastructure throughout the state. There are 1,138 post offices in Ireland. The banks are pulling back from dealing with retail customers in very many ways.
Yeah.
An alignment between the post office of the future
and the credit,
the credit union movement provides opportunities for the kind of thing I think
and we keep it
that
in
you
the
were talking about and keeping it at local level.
And just one other thing, Brendan, from I'd say,
Mary,
people, as we see in all of the opinion polls, we know, don't trust government. I'm not talking about this government. They don't trust government. They don't trust political parties. I think they trust individual politicians more than they trust the generality of politicians.
Yeah.
People will go to Pat individually, they'll come to me individually and all other politicians. So naturally then, they're not going to trust a government body or the politicians to solve their personal problems because they feel that we created them for them in the first place. So the more voluntary activity that you have, which has always been at the basis of good community in Ireland, and the more of these organisations that you have that can help to support people, and dare I say, going back to the initial point, an act of kindness. The idea that somebody would actually believe in somebody else is very often what they need.
Well, I said this many,
that you believe
many times.
In their hope and in their idea.
Absolutely.
And in their aim, and that can give them the encouragement to keep going.
I started my career in the entertainment industry on a self-employment scheme from the Labour. I was on the dole and I went on a self-employment scheme. It was a great scheme at the time. I think it was a labour idea too. It was that you got an opportunity to go self-employed if you had an idea that they thought might give you an opportunity to do that. And you could collect your dole for up to 10 months while you were doing that. Had I not had that 10-month dole, I couldn't have never have made an attempt to go and do that. So there are some great schemes. I'm not saying that, and I wasn't saying that we should have a Quango or a government body that should replace Phoenix. What I'm saying is that if there was, there should be some kind of communication between the likes of Phoenix and some kind of support mechanism within the government that's not multi-party. I'm not talking within the Oireachtas, multi-party, whereby Phoenix have a phone call they can make, Phoenix have support that they can get. And they seem to have a ridiculously hard time dealing with the banks right now. I mean, banks are giving them an awful time. We're talking about 70,000 repossessions they're talking about over the next whatever. There has to be some way they can get some kind of support. We own the banks. I mean, you know, in theory, there has to be some way that Phoenix
can... No, we only own some of them.
Really?
We only own AIB as far as investment charges.
We're a shareholder in Bank of Ireland,
yeah.
And we're only a shareholder in Bank of Ireland. Whatever, the point I'm making is that I'm not suggesting that it should be a government quango, that all these things have to go through, but there should be something within the Oireachtas that deals specifically with Phoenix and the likes of it. I'm not just talking about the Phoenix, I'm talking about the Vincent de Paul as well, and to feel the pulse of the nation. I have to listen to Liveline to find out what's going on. And we shouldn't have to do that. I should be able to listen to a Oireachtas report to find out what's going on.
Well, we know, and rightly so, well, it's arguable, when Susie, the student grant debacle was going on for the last year or so, they set up a special hotline for TDs, for members of the Oireachtas, to ring Susie, and they had a special email account for members of the Oireachtas to ring Susie. Is that what you were thinking of, that Phoenix would have link into...
A call they could make, a direct route that they could make to both inform the Oireachtas as to what was going on the ground. Because, you know, the general belief out there is that the government are detached from this, and that the Oireachtas in many ways is detached from this, that they don't really know what's going on out there.
Well, I mean,
I'm just saying that's a general feeling. I'm not saying that's the truth.
I recently had the opportunity to speak to what are known as LEOs. These are local employment offices that are now based in every county in the country. This is a pulling together of various strands to create a one-stop shop where there is access for people like you are describing to get mentoring and to get advice and so
from
on.
All
and so
from all different areas.
Yeah. And, you know, I think they're working well. And, you know, they are now available in each county. And, you know, it is, I think, a valuable source of advice for the future. But I mean, at the end of the day, Brendan, a lot of this is about access to credit.
Yes.
That's the problem. And you're right. I mean, the banks are still extremely niggardly about it, partly because I suppose they're anticipating the stress tests that are coming up in the autumn and are still working at getting their internal ratios into kilter.
To balance,
But you know, I mean, if you look at, for example, the problem that has suddenly developed in Dublin of a housing need because of the supply situation, one of the reasons is that the builders who have been left standing and who have the capability of building homes, and there aren't many of them, believe it or not, are being refused credit on the basis of their banking record 5 or 6 years ago.
Which is, at this point, is irrelevant.
Yeah, and they won't, they're not being loaned the facilities that are needed. It takes 12 to 18 months, as Journal knows, it takes 12 to 18 months to get a site through planning permission, design, blah, 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 and all the rest. And during that time, they have to be carried. They don't have the resources now. And that means accessing credit. And that is proving difficult in some circumstances.
It's extraordinary that this is the time when it would be in the bank's best interest, for want of a better way of putting it, to give them the credit they need, because the value of lands is at a very low in comparison to Celtic Tiger. The cost of raw materials, the cost of building is cheaper. There is a housing shortage, and now is the time. If I was a bank, is now I would be lending money, because certainly in the latter ends of the Celtic Tiger, I wouldn't have been lending money. But also, if you then address another issue, and it's covered by Valerie Handy a little bit in the mail today, if you go back to, it's well and fine advising people how to get out of these problems, but it's another another task altogether to try and regenerate the economy, as Pat and others are trying to do. And I go back to this thing we just spoke about earlier about the quangos. They talk about a 2 billion adjustment that's required. We're spending between 18 and 20 billion euros a year on quangos. Some of them, like the Galway Harbour Commission, doesn't have a turnover greater than the Spar supermarket in a small town. But it has a board of representatives. It has employees. It's an extraordinary. We've up to 800 quangos. We've two quangos. One is set up to find out what the others are doing. And the other quangos to set up to make sure we try and cut down overlapping. They're competing for the same business. So what I'm saying, and I've been saying for years, is let's deal with a real issue there. There's no point in saying, as I know the present government talked about 140 quangos to be abolished, and I think there's 47 gone when I last counted, but there's 33 introduced, and some of them are more expensive than the ones gone. Deal with quangos. Get the money back into the people. Get it into frontline. I've spoken about it many times in the past. And that's something that I would plead the minister and the government to continue to concentrate on, because that's where the saving is. The money will go back into the economy and back into the people in frontline services, people who need it. And that's the point. And it's covered actually in this article here, where they're talking about Jimmy Deanahan advertising people free, work free on state boards, with six people appointed to unpaid positions in the Arts Council. It now transpires they're all being paid money plus expenses. Do you mean, that's what I have a problem with. And it's just to try and
find... Is that frustrating, Minister? Is that frustrating to see, you know, the likes of plans that you have to abolish 140 odd quangos, and then to see, you know, 23 new ones coming in? I mean,
well, you see, when you sit down and you look at this, you have to go through them one by one. I mean, would you abolish the IDA? Would you abolish Science Foundation Ireland?
No, would you abolish you can cherry pick the ones that you
would
abolish.
Would you abolish the court service? Would you abolish the Arts Council? Would you abolish the Geological Survey of Ireland?
Consumer liaison panel. The Galway Harbour Commission, which has a turnover of less than, as I say, a Spar supermarket, small town. I'll give you a list of 100. I have them all here. Yeah, I'm working.
But the Galway Harbour Commission has a purpose.
I've no doubt.
There are vessels that come into Galway Harbour, and there is a reasoning behind it.
I've no doubt. Sorry for interrupting. I've no doubt there's a reason behind everything here. But if you have up to 800 quangos, there's one quango, as I say, to try and work out how many quangos there are and what they're doing. The other one is to try and overlapping. I'm not suggesting we abolish all quangos.
Would you do me a favour? Just explain to me exactly what a quango is.
It's a quasi-governmental agency. And it's there set up there. Like, I mean, I've listed them. It's a quasi-non-governmental agency. I believe that, first of all, a lot of them, and McCarthy did a great report, which I thought, in relation to this, where a lot of them could be amalgamated. It's 17 to 20 billion on these quangos. And I'm not saying, because sometimes in this country we go from one extreme to the other, I'm not saying abolish all quangos. That's what I'm saying at all. What I'm saying is there's a massive amount of overlapping. And anybody who has time, read the SNP report in relation to quangos. And it's frightening. In fact, at times you actually laugh your way through it. This is not to say there's not a purpose to these. We just can't afford it. And instead of hitting people with water charges and talk about more taxes, is to get this saving into place. And there's a huge amount to be saved here. I actually believe, and I'm doing a very detailed report, or sorry, investigation. It's been on for the last 2 years, but it keeps changing. I can't get the information out of them. There's 5 or 6 billion to be saved here. Put that money back into the people. It's the same thing I talked about the HSE last time I was here. They came on and started contradicting me. I'm speaking to consultants. I went to Talla Hospital last Friday night, late night, and the people in there will tell you that a third of their time is spent in HSE pen pushing business. For every 100 cents, every euro, there's up to 40 cents been spent on pen pushing administrative work. It's the nurses we need to support, the doctors and consultants, and people like Pat are doing a great job. If they could just get more encouragement, push on with this reform, get the money back into the system, stop hitting the same people all the time, stop hitting the people at the lower end of the scale and people who are working like myself to try and pay bills, there is a saving to be made, but it needs a very strong, constructive, hard approach. And I'm not talking about abolishing all quangos. That's what I'm talking about. I have a list of them here. It's unbelievable. But, I'm going to give them to the minister.
Just hold on a second, Gerald. A minister, a Mary, because you again, both of you would be looking at this. If the money was there to be saved, surely you would save it. I mean, it's
well, you see, I mean, like I asked about the IDA, or, you know, would you abolish the Irish Blood Transfusion Service?
No.
You know, when you go through, for example, in my own case, for example, in recent weeks I've been involved in the Dublin City Council taking over responsibility, albeit I hope with a measure of autonomy, of the digital hub. Now, that's one of the quangos that Gerald is talking about. And I'm not at all convinced, and I'm doing it, that it's the right thing to do. Because the digital hub is about the digital economy that we're already in and is the future of this country. Encouraging young people in terms of the digital skills and enabling small companies to be spawned before they leave the digital hub and make their way in the world and so on. It had difficulties because it was a property play that went wrong, or it was associated with a property play because of the buildings around there and all that kind of thing. But it seems to me that the digital hub is the kind of new enterprise area that we should be encouraging. So if you go down
there's another element to the question. Of course, no one is advocating the IDA double chin. No one's in their right mind. We haven't got that mad. But there's another element to Quangos, and that is they need money. One, they get money from the taxpayer, which I think is what Gerald's
aiming at. Yeah.
But the second thing is they have to raise revenue. And the likes of, for example, we get it all the time, Professional Security Authority is a Quango. They now charge, and their latest fee grabbing, and we've got it for 3 or 4 years in Liveline. Anyone who wants to install an alarm, a small firm trying to install it, they now have to register and pay an annual fee to the PSA, which is not insignificant. Now the PSA are going after, who are they going after? The locksmiths.
So you have to have a license now to sell a lock.
So they want, and basically, people see it as another form of taxation. Small businesses. Mm. Repack, for example, is another. You have to have your. It's a sticker on the window, and people are surprised when they discover that Repack doesn't actually recycle anything. You pay separately to get rid of your waste. But if you don't have that sticker on the window, and at the end, and the same with the PSA, at the end of the day, if you don't pay the money, you could end up in prison because it is a state body. That is the draconian element that people are small businesses especially are very, very.
But a lot of these issues, Joe, are about standards on which we were very lax in the past.
There was no great.
But surely standards can be upped with education, can be upped with enforcement without having.
But I mean, let's take any page of journal script here in front of me. And let's see how many of them we will abolish before the programme is out. I suggest that there is a very compelling argument for very many of them. You take any one of them there that you want to look at, do we want to abolish the National Lottery? Do we want to abolish On Board Beer, which is marketing Irish food products successfully abroad? Do we want to abolish On Board Planola? And do we want to let the chaos
on this country? I don't think it's fair. I think, Pat, can I just say one thing?
Pat, you're not suggesting that there's nothing on that list could be abolished.
This is what I'm saying.
Sorry, Kerry, go ahead.
Come back in. The Quango argument was part of the last election. They came in. I don't believe that this government decided, we'll do something completely different. They probably kind of examined things. The key thing, and this is what Joe is touching on, is that in our search for standards, and worse, in our fear of being caught without standards, without rules, with what was it, light touch regulation, we have turned into the most god-awful bureaucracy. This country is unlivable because of form filling, because of footy little details.
It's not indigenous to Ireland.
No, but it is special to Ireland because in many cases, for example, public bodies putting out tender processes for quite small amounts of money. At this stage, companies like mine are looking at them and saying,
it's not worth
the effort to go through all that bureaucratic form filling. Leave it alone. That's anti-business. It's anti-enterprise. It's anti-excitement. It's anti-possibility.
Gerard, what were you going to say?
What I was going to say is that we've got to be very careful here not to get lost. I mean, what Pat is saying, and he's speaking of ones that are, nobody's talking about abolishing. This is an emergency. There are people, I went down to Penny Dinners and spent 4 hours peeling potatoes for 280 homeless people. I thought they were homeless yesterday. I go down regularly. I thought they were homeless. They weren't homeless at all. The people can't afford to put food on the table.
Yes.
They can't afford it. I said, you have no house. And they said, no, we do. I said, what are you doing here? Well,
they wouldn't be homeless if they weren't being fed.
If they weren't being fed. And you know, it's okay. We have a financial right. First of all, I believe in the civil servants who work in the departments. And someday, Pat, hopefully he's going to invite me over because I want to meet the civil servants because I think they're great people. I don't know what they're doing. Because if you've got a financial regulator, you have a financial service ombudsman bureau, you have a financial service authority of Ireland, you have a financial service consultative consumer panel, financial service consultative industry panel, financial service ombuds council,
you're now getting so passionate that I don't even know what you're saying.
Oh, sorry. I'm just going through all the quangos just in one section.
I can see that.
And everyone has a board and everyone has employees.
But it's a very interesting area, though, that you select, Gerald, you know, because the reason that we are on our uppers is because financial regulation didn't work.
Yeah.
Non-regulation.
Can I say to you, a lot of these were in place at the time.
It's a fair
total
point.
Total failures. It's total failure. It was in place at the time. And what are we going to do now? We set another quango to investigate why those quangos didn't work.
Yeah,
and we give everybody 35,000 each, and then we'll pay more employees.
But we need financial regulation.
Nobody's saying we don't. I mean, this is ludicrous. Nobody's saying we don't. What I'm saying is your financial regulator, Financial Service Ombudsman Bureau, Financial Service Authority of Ireland, Financial Service Consultative Consumer Panel, Financial Service Consultative Industry Panel, Financial Service Ombudsman Council. What I'm saying, don't turn it around that I'm saying, oh, let's forget about regulation. We've had so much regulation, we don't know where we are. We just can't enforce it. We can't ensure it's complied with and we can't see it through. What we do is we introduce more quangos, and I'm just getting so annoyed that people in this country who want help can get it if we attack the areas that should be attacked. And I think there's a massive waste of money. I've said it before, I'm saying no more on it. And it's up to people to make up their own minds.
Talking about a waste of money, there is just to go back to the papers and the Mail on Sunday and in other papers as well, Eddie Hobbs is writing about it, Shane Ross is writing about it in the Sunday Indo, about the banking inquiry. And the general consensus seems to be that the bank inquiry is going to be another waste of money. Is going to be a
waste
of money.
But you know, Joe, I heard exactly those same arguments when we did the Dirt inquiry, which was the last banking inquiry.
Yourself and Jim Mitchell, I know that.
Yeah,
but
the point I'm making is that it's very interesting if you look at the publicity that preceded it.
It's on the basis of evidence. That is, for example, the recent Anglo-Irish trial, right, where Patrick Neary, the financial regulator, this is a criminal trial, where if you tell lies at a criminal trial, if you are a witness, you are open to contempt of court, and you are open to the possibility, it's happened in the UK, Jeffrey Archer, Jonathan Aiken sent to prison when they were caught telling lies in the witness box. Patrick Neary, the financial regulator, who this state decided when he retired was worthy of a €630,000 handout and is now worthy of €140,000 annual pension, right? Taxpayers' money, every cent taxpayers' money. Patrick Neary said, truthfully, let's not doubt that, truthfully, in the witness box, 82 separate occasions that he could not remember, could not recall, did not keep a note. We could give this guy 630,000 of the day he left.
We couldn't give him a borrow in a pad.
We couldn't give him a big borrow. He said 82 times. So how is the banking inquiry, which is already, we're now talking about extra resources in the Dáil of one and a half, two million.
Well, I think the answer to that,
how's it going to advance
when they're not going to be under the Dirt inquiry collected money effectively.
At the end of the day? The banking inquiry will not collect money.
The Dirt inquiry was very focused and very...
The Dirt inquiry actually brought in just in excess of €1 billion. But it was subjected to the same kind of commentary before it happened.
But
just let me make the point. The same commentary, the first week, for example, brought ridicule from some of the scribes at that time. They weren't laughing at week two or week three. And in the circumstances that we've been discussing here and what caused this discussion, nothing so serious has ever happened to the economy of this country as the economic crash and the banking collapse. And I think the point is that people want to see those who were charged with regulation and supervision of regulation and our institutions, where did they fail? They want to see people subjected to reasonable questioning and to judge the quality of their answers. They want to learn the lessons for the future. And, you know, it seems to me, yes, you're right. This banking inquiry is likely to face more challenges than did we when we did the Dirt inquiry back 16, 17 years ago, whenever it was. But I think, you know, there is a strong, compelling argument in a democracy for inquiry by parliamentary committee.
There have been three of them already.
To allow
there have been three inquiries already. Honohan,
Not parliamentary inquiry.
But the other thing, and also the Anglo trial. We got an awful lot of information from the Anglo trial. Now, a lot of it was in the public domain through journalism or whatever. Yeah. But there's a lot of information. I'm just saying what I'm hearing is.
Are we going to find out any more with a banking inquiry than we already know?
I don't know what we're going to find out.
Harvesting any income from it for a start. Of course, you'll harvest lessons, maybe. But are the lessons already and not already there?
I'm not sure what lessons we're going to learn, but I do think it's valuable to have it. Because people want to ask questions. And the money that's been talked about at the moment that it will cost, a lot of it initially is going to be cosmetic money insofar as changing the facilities in Leinster House, which to me seems to be entirely unnecessary.
Well, there's lawyers involved.
And of course there'll be lawyers involved and everything else.
We've already stated
we think, you know, this is not the way to go. I think the Taoiseach has already made it quite clear that he has a predetermined idea as to what the results of it are going to be, the whole debacle in relation to the formation of the committee, but having said that, I think we should do it.
Well, I'd like to come back and talk about the Taoiseach's idea of the formation and see what. But before we do, let's take a break because we have to sell some ads and I have to go for a wee wee. Now, welcome back. That was a short break, but I just made it. Joined by Conor Pope. Conor, you're more than welcome.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
You've been listening on the way in.
Yeah, they're all very grumpy. Who? And I have to say, your entire panel, I have to say, one of the things I completely disagreed with was...
They won't let us have any alcohol.
No, you started off the programme and you made a very good point. And you asked why the state had played no role in setting up some kind of body to help indebted people deal with their problems.
Well, no, they have, no.
No, I'm talking about, you were talking about the Phoenix Group and you were wondering why the state hadn't got involved. And everyone around the table disagreed with you and said that was no role for the state. And I have to say, I completely agree with you and I completely disagree with all the people here, particularly the minister, because the state's responsibility is to help its citizens. And it has been completely derelict in that responsibility for the last 6 or 7 years. It's not good enough to say we have MABS. MABS is a good organisation. It's doing a good job, but it doesn't have the resources and it doesn't have the teeth to help people who can't pay their mortgages or who are being bullied and harassed by banks, by credit card companies and by all sorts of lenders who gave them money irresponsibly. And it just kills me to hear all these people saying, no, the state has no role in that. The state does have a role and it has let everyone down. And I take grave exception to, particularly when you talk about the bankruptcy legislation that was passed in this country.
Yeah.
It's flawed on almost every level.
But I think we all knew it would be.
But the minister didn't do anything about it.
No, but in order to get some kind of legislation through, it had to go through flawed. Am I right, Minister? Or was it? I mean, if we had to wait for the perfect act to go through, we would still be waiting.
You would, and I'm not sure it's fair of Conor to say that everybody around the table said there was no role for the state. I don't think anybody said there was no role for the state. The
difficulty. That's what you said.
Well, I certainly didn't say that, and I instanced MABS. I instanced the possibilities of synergies between the credit union movement and the post office. And the solvency legislation enacted by government was designed to do precisely what you say. Now, whether it's defective or whether it's in need of refurbishment or to be tweaked here or tweaked there, I mean, it did address the issue of bankruptcy law in this country and it did address a route for individuals in difficulty with their mortgages.
To a point.
But, you know, there is... I mean, if Conor, and I know he has written about this particular area, if Conor has workable solutions, I'm all ears to hear them.
I don't have to have the solutions, Minister. The solutions are out there. We could look at what they did in Finland. We could look at what they did in France. And the manner in which the French, for instance, gave its central bank real teeth, and it was a carrot and stick approach when dealing with the banks. So if the bank... Right now, we have a problem in this country in that the bank who has the mortgage can have a veto on any agreement reached between somebody who goes through the personal solvency process. Isn't that correct?
Well, it is, Conor.
And it is also correct, Conor,
that it is that way because that was the legal advice that we got.
But that's no excuse, Minister.
Whatever solutions you put in place have to be consonant with law. You can't, in this country's constitution, intrude in the private property rights of any citizen or organisation without undue...
I don't think Conor actually means that. If you're bringing in something that has to be... You can change the law. That's what you're there for. You can check. If you think the law needs tweaking to facilitate the Insolvency Act in some way.
You can change the law, but you can't change the private property rights enshrined in our constitution unless the people decide
but
to do that.
Nobody was suggesting that. What I thought might have been a good idea when they were introducing the bankruptcy legislation was to give an arbiter, an independent third third wheel, if you like.
Please don't say Quango.
No, we're not going to talk about Quangos anymore. But to give somebody else a chance or an opportunity to bring the banks to heel. Because the problem we have now is if I'm indebted and if I'm on my uppers and I can't afford to pay my mortgage, I have to go cap in hand to the bank. And I'm utterly dependent on that bank.
Their decision.
Their decisions are sacrosanct. I have no power and I have no independent body to go to try and seek redress. If the banks say no to me and I've come to them with my personal solvency practitioner and I'm on my knees begging them to do a deal, the bank can just say no. They don't have to give a reason and I have no referee to go to appeal that. Now, I'm not suggesting that we change...
Minister, was that ever part of the legislation? Was that
I mean, the situation is that since 2008, the criticisms advanced by most financial analysts is that the banks haven't acted speedily enough in terms of the mortgage issue.
A dog in the street and will tell you.
But in fact, the situation since 2008 is that there have been minimal repossessions. And what Connor is now highlighting is that it is anticipated in the 2-3 years ahead that situation is now coming to a head. And he is saying that the legislative measures put in place by government are not adequate to protect, give people optimum protection in those circumstances. Sadly, it is a fact of life that there are going to be some repossessions. And sadly, it is a fact of life that some people who got mortgages ought never have got mortgages.
But Minister, this chain of events always, and maybe I'm wrong here, but this circle of always has me bothered. And I could be wrong, but tell me if I am wrong. I know people who are working, and they're working really hard, but still not making enough to meet the mortgage that they're trying to pay.
That's right.
But they're still working. And in there, they're getting their wages taxed and levied. And that money is going in some shape or form to some of the banks.
But property,
the banks that are putting them out of their homes that they can't afford to keep because they're giving money to the banks.
Property prices fell by 50%, Brendan, in this country.
I know, but why doesn't everybody take a hit? It doesn't seem to be that the banks are taking a hit.
The banking system in this country gave out mortgages to get young people, the argument was, their first toe on the ladder.
That they shouldn't have given.
The first toe on the ladder. Some of them couldn't afford the ladder. I mean, there were reckless mortgages given out at the time. And the supervision and financial invigilation that we've talking about was manifestly inadequate. The credit expansion was visible before the eyes of anybody whose job was monitoring the financial sector in this country. And it was allowed to happen. And we are now stuck with the fallout from that. And Connor says it's not his job, and he's right, to put forward the solutions. But I haven't seen workable solutions being advanced elsewhere. It may well be, as Connor says, that the financial insolvency legislation put in place in the light of experience now needs to be refurbished.
Or to give us access to a central bank that will bring the banks to heel, that if I go to a bank and I'm not getting a satisfactory or a fair shake of it, that I have somebody else to go to who will have teeth.
And interestingly enough, that is exactly
the point
what they
of the
do in France.
Ombudsman the journal wants to abolish. I mean,
he wants to abolish the Galway Port organisation for some inexplicable reason. Well, I'm from Galway, and I think that plays an important role.
I mean, there's two sides.
And that's
this.
Point of Crangles. Everybody thinks it plays a role.
Yeah, I think Connor. I mean, I don't know if Connor's living in the real world at all, which worries me a little bit because if he's turning around and suggesting here the government need to be brought in to help, the government are not capable of helping. And I don't know where Connor's been for the last few years. They're not capable of helping. What they need to do is deal with the macro issues to get the micro economy to help the people, as I've said already. It's kind of silly of Connor to talk about the
Galway. God bless your naivety, Jerry. Do you think the Irish government...
Connor, and this is what worries me about some people like this. He comes in and attacks everybody. He then says, Gerald wants to abolish the Galway Commission, which is ludicrous. Carry on.
What I'm saying
is that plus many more He's implying that you abolish one commission, which has a turnover spar supermarket in the town, that that's it. No, I'm talking about a mass. It's up to 800. I'm talking about abolishing. There's about 100 to 150 there that are easily identifiable, which is done by the government. So let's get back to the real issues here, which is there's only so much government to do. The government a lot of time are hindering the rejuvenation, and the people there need a process, and they do need it. But I mean,
I think Gerald is right about one point, which is that there is no solution to the problem that Connor is articulating without getting the macroeconomic situation right. And Gerald is certainly right about that. And that is precisely what the government has been doing, and in respect of which the government has made tremendous progress. We are now in circumstances again where we can borrow money at affordable rates to run this economy ourselves. And that is a major turnaround. 71,000 additional people at work is a major turnaround, because that's the real route out of poverty, to put people back to work. The problem you've highlighted, Brendan, which is that there are a lot of people at work who are finding it very difficult to make ends meet. And that's wrong. That's the real crisis.
The feeling I got in that room yesterday, and this is most important for me, people aren't looking for a handout, Minister. They're looking for a leg up. That's all. They're not looking for a handout. Nobody asked. I was very lucky to be in a position to give that man some money. But the rest of that room had equally heartbreaking stories. And I would have loved to have helped everybody. But I couldn't. But nobody asked. Nobody said, well, look, is my story not bad enough?
But, Brendan, are we saying that the greatest economic...
They feel abandoned. That's
but are
what
we
I'm
saying that the greatest economic cataclysm to hit this country since independence, that somehow we should be able to sail through it without there being fallout all over the place?
No, I'm not saying that. What I am saying, though, as a socialist, we can do better. Yes. We can do it better. We can do it with heart. We can do it with soul. We can do it with a little bit of contemplation of what people are going through right on the ground. There's absolutely no reason why anybody in this country, we're not a rich country, but we're not a poor country.
No.
There's no reason why anybody in this world can't heat their house. Why a 90-year-old woman can't buy food, or why an 8-year-old has to get excited about seeing porridge coming into the house.
Well, as I said to you...
That's embarrassing. I find that embarrassing.
As I said to you, I didn't hear your programme yesterday, but,
But you know that they exist.
I do know they exist. I also know from having been in both Athens and Rome in recent weeks that the safety net that we have managed to keep in place in this country is something that I am proud of, compared to, for example,
the situation confronting
citizens, for example, in Greece. We have managed to keep a safety net. But this issue of the financial collapse, as it relates to the issue that Connor is raising of mortgages and financial insolvency and all the rest, is extraordinarily difficult. You have a paper there in front of you that is looking at the collapse of Tony O'Reilly's empire. I mean, can anything more dramatically highlight for us what has happened in this country in recent years than that particular downfall?
No, but at the same time, they're also pointing out that it was one of the banks that was unnecessarily helping him. That brought it to a head.
Well, I think what's probably even more interesting is if you look at the Sunday Business Post, rather than looking at Tony O'Reilly, where you see that there's a very big difference between the macro that Pat is talking about and what individual people feel, because the opinion poll there is saying that people see their own personal circumstances as being completely different to what people are talking about nationally. So nationally, you might be talking about a small recovery and you might be talking about 70,000 extra jobs, but you ask people themselves, what do they feel? And you see that they're struggling. And people feel that they're struggling.
But there's no surprise about that, Mary.
It's important to continue to bring it back down to the local level. And the very people that you're talking about, Brendan, the 35 to 54-year-old age group, the people with children, the people with mortgages, that they're the people that have to continue to be supported.
But that doesn't get away from the fundamental point that there will be no economic recovery if we don't get the economy right.
I know that. But there will be no confidence in people if they don't feel that they're benefiting from it. Of course, I know you have to get the national picture right. You have to ensure that there's more employment. You have to ensure that there's money in circulation. But families who are listening this morning, they have to feel it themselves. And I noticed it particularly in the recent weeks, even in the election, that even where people weren't affected themselves, or who might put themselves in the category of stable, using one of the words of the opinion poll, they're worried about the, their own families and their own children
and the future
and the next generation
and the next generation, because the answers always have been for us in previous recessions, and God knows I've seen a few in previous recessions, was that, you know, well, you know what, the next generation won't have to put up with this because we're putting money into education, we're educating them better, we're giving them better qualifications. We had, when we opened up free secondary education, it was a marvellous thing, and then free university education, we were going to have to
absolutely
brains.
True, Brendan.
No, but that's not happening now. Now we're taking the money out of education.
I was just about to say, it has been taken out of education.
So what we're doing is we're penalising this generation, and we're now restricting the avenues of the future generation.
So you have to make the decisions at a macro level, of course, but it's the decisions that each government minister and each department has to make. They're the ones that impact on families. So whether that's medical cards, or whether that's about money going into schools, or whether it's about supporting the disadvantaged schools and the DESH schools, or whatever level, that's where the decision making is being questioned, I believe, by people at the moment.
I think Brendan, is important though, you know, I mean, I'm not pro-austerity. I'm pro-solvency.
People think you are, John.
I know that. But I'm pro-solvency, and until we are solvent and until this economy is on the road to recovery, we will not be able to provide employment for our people and provide the wherewithal to maintain that safety net at an adequate level that no citizen of ours has to endure, no heating in their home or the other issues that you advanced.
But in the meantime, they do.
There are people, there are some people out there who have endured very considerable hardship since the crash.
And they're the weakest. There is no doubt
about that.
They're not the people who had to sell their yacht. You know what I mean? They are the weakest.
I know the distinction.
And really, I actually remember you saying many years ago, I heard you make a speech on how a country should be judged. And you probably don't remember yourself, though you usually remember everything you say. But you said something in the start that a country should be judged on not how it treats its best people, but how it treats its weakest people. And if that was the truth, yeah. I'd ask you, Pat, to sit back and relax and say, well, how would we judge Ireland right now?
Yeah, I do remember, and the author of that particular phrase is James Connolly, and I think it's as valid a test today as it was then. But, you know, this government has had forced on them very unpopular decisions with a view to recovering our economic solvency and our economic sovereignty.
But, Pat, to all due respect, nobody asked you to go into government. You knew that going in, and all you had to say was not for us.
Well, Brendan, we are where we are.
No, we are where we are.
That doesn't get us anywhere.
And I'm not trying to.
The common thread, even in the newspapers, and what Pat was saying and what Gerard was saying earlier, the common thread is that the banks haven't taken the hit. It's the borrowers that took the hit. Now, whenever whenever somebody went into a bank, if we presume they weren't wearing a balaclava, whenever somebody went into a bank and said, will you give me a mortgage for a house? Will you lend me money to build an extension? And also, in Tony O'Reilly's case, will you give me ABCD? We presume the banks. That was their job, and there was enough of them, and they're well paid, and they still are very well paid. We presume the banks said, okay, hang on, we'll have a look at this project, be it a house or be it a concert hall. We'll have a look at this project, and will it work or will it not work? They took a risk. The borrower took a risk, but the common thread seems to be that everyone that borrowed in the country, from the young couple up to Tony O'Reilly, and it's hard to...
are paying the price.
The borrowers are paying the price, but the banks and the bankers haven't taken the hit. The banks again and again and again get their way.
I think Joe's made a very good point there, because the level of reckless lending that we saw between 1995 and 2007, 2008 was scandalous. You had banks giving out 110% mortgages while doing drive-by valuations of the properties that the mortgages were to be on. They had absolutely no sense of responsibility. And this is coming off a backdrop where in the 70s and 60s and 50s, banks were incredibly responsible, and they would lend 2.5 times your salary, and if there was a couple working, plus 1.5 times the lower salary. And that was the rule, and it was rigidly enforced.
I can remember when you had to have 25% of it saved in the EBS for three years.
But what terrifies me now, Brendan, is despite the collapse and despite all of the stuff that we should have learned from the collapse, are we sleepwalking into making the same mistakes again? Just this week it emerged from the CSO figures that property prices in Dublin increased by 22% between May of 2013 and May of this year. That's a rate of increase which mirrors the increases that were recorded during the height of the bubble.
Yeah.
And who is controlling that?
But that's directly related to lack of supply.
Connor, is that You know, a year ago, you couldn't sell your house. The situation has changed because a way back for the last 15 years or longer, we have been transferring our social housing need into private rented accommodation. We don't have the stock of social housing. Now we have a shortage of supply of any kind of housing, given that young people who are 23 and 24 when the crash happened are now 30. And in those circumstances, we have to get the build up again. And builders were not prepared until this year to build homes that in which there was no profit, that it cost as much to build the house as it would sell for on the market. Now that trigger has been passed. Now a situation where there has been a rise in prices of houses is very difficult for first-time buyers, but it will mean that houses are going to be built again. And there is no solution to the housing situation in Dublin until we tackle supply. And we need more housing output. It is now profitable to build houses again. It wasn't profitable because the cost of building a house was roughly the equivalent of what you would sell it for
on the market.
Conor Pope came in
Terry.
In extremely aggressive and unpleasant form and with a bad attitude. And he served
you sounded
as
like my teacher there, you did. You sounded like my...
He was
giving
out
you have a note about from your mother, Carol.
He was giving out about
I seem to upset
grumpy.
Terry Prone. How terrible.
And one of the things that I do think that we should do before we finish this morning is to say, look...
Get Conor to apologise.
There is progress in some areas in this country, and it is reflected hugely in one common strand throughout all of the Sunday newspapers today in their coverage of Dublin Pride and the parade. It is the most fantastically positive thing. Colm O'Gorman has a fabulous piece in the Sunday Business Post about where it can go from here. And the Mail on Sunday links it to a fabulous three pages about the fact that the Gardaí, under pressure like everybody else, are actually doing interesting community stuff. We are not all the time back in the past. Some things, some aspects of Irish life are progressing remarkably well.
Well, funny you should say that, because in going back to the small area policing that's being suggested as a thing, we are going back to the past, which I have no problem with. So we are going back to the past. And then you ask yourself, although the gay pride is a tremendous success and it's fantastic to see it here, have we advanced at all in equality? Have we?
Yes,
well,
we have.
I think we have.
Hold on. We're going to be talking about that. I just thought I'd provoke you there. We talk about that after the news. Many thanks, Michael Murphy. Welcome back to the Marion Finucan Show. This is not Marion. She has a little bit more hair than I do, and she's also a lot prettier. We've lost a minister and we've lost Terry, but we have been joined by Rory Cowan from Mrs. Brown's Boys. Rory, you're not here because we need a token gay to talk about the gay pride thing.
Of course
but,
I am.
But while you are here, yesterday's gay pride, how did it go?
Well, I missed the parade because I was down at the Curragh, but I went into town later on and all the bars, town was packed. It was a fantastic day. It was absolutely brilliant. It was just wonderful. I remember Gay Pride years ago when it started off. You'd be lucky to get maybe 50 or 60 people just blowing whistles and walking up Dame Street. But now there was thousands of people.
Friday night.
But now there's thousands of people at it. They had to close at the front lounge, which goes down to a Soldes Tower. They closed the back road there for, and it was just packed with people. And the same then at Panty Bar in Capel Street.
I saw the papers were describing it as only second to St. Patrick's Day Parade.
Oh, no, that's what it looked like in town yesterday. It was unbelievable. That's, and the atmosphere was fabulous.
I'm really talking about the chat in the bars, etc., the chat in general, because we had a lot of gays coming from all over the world to Ireland. Have we progressed? Is there a great hope for the gay future in Ireland?
Well, I think everybody is hopeful, but they're not optimistic. I don't know what it is. Like the stuff with gay marriage, if that was to happen, that would be fantastic. But nobody knows when that's going to happen. We've got government ministers saying, oh, we'll talk about this and we'll have a referendum on that. But the referendum never seems to come. And I don't know why they don't have the referendum, because I think maybe there would be a huge majority that would vote in favour of it. Because people are in favour of equal rights.
I was getting a feeling of a more positive aspect from gay people, more positive about it rather than that it's not going to happen. Do you think they're more cynical?
I think they're more cynical because they know it's going to... there's a great lobby group called GLEN, And they're lobbying the government all the time, and they're doing Trojan work. But it's, I don't know, when you've got to get a lobby group to try and educate people in government, you sort of think, well, if they're not really up to speed on things and you need a lobby group to try and educate them, how long is it going to take? We've been talking about this for a good few years now, and it doesn't seem to have gone any further. We're still at the same stage where we'll do something next year, but next year never comes.
But we're not the only ones. It seems to be a world. Elton John did an interview with Sky this morning, and he talked about the global situation. Do we have a short clip?
Globally, you know, we seem to have gone backwards over the last 18 months in certain areas. And it's a cause. I mentioned this on stage on Thursday night, and I said, you know, as long as I'm alive, till I'm, you know, I will fight for people's rights. Anybody whose human rights are wronged or taken away from them, I will try and fight them. I will try and go to Russia. I am going to Russia in December, on November, and I will try and meet Putin, and I will try and talk to him. I don't know what good it'll do, but unless you build a bridge, it's no good putting up a wall and say, I'm not talking to these people. The only thing that gets solved is by talking to people.
Oh, there you go. And he's going to meet. And he met, I think he's going to try. Did he meet Putin today?
No, he's going to try and do it and try and meet him. And I hope so, because the situation in Russia is terrible. I mean, there's gay people being beaten up in the streets and everything. And the ones who are being.
Is it still illegal in Russia to be gay?
No, it's not illegal. But I think what the situation is, you can't promote it. And that's what it is. And like when they say promoting it, like you can't really have any. You can't be an advocate for gay rights, because that could be influencing children and stuff. That's the way they see it over there. And so you can't say anything.
It's hard to believe that homosexuality was only decriminalised in 1993.
That's what I was going to say. We're not fair past that.
When you wrote Mrs. Brown's Boys first and you introduced Rory and Dino, it was illegal to be gay in Ireland.
I remember the hassle of it, yeah.
And if you remember the times when we went round the country and people would come up to us and they'd say, oh, we love that character, Rory, and we think he's fabulous. We have an uncle like that, but we never spoke about it. And that was the way it was. People knew that they were there, but they never spoke about it. So I always think Brendan sort of pushed the envelope a bit. Do you know what I mean? He made people talk.
Mary, are they a powerful lobby, the gay lobby?
I think they're more influential lobby now than they were. And certainly reading Colm O'Gorman's article today, which I think deals with the issues very sensitively and carefully, actually. You know, I mean, he does highlight the differences that have happened over the 30 years when one could easily forget that a young man was beaten in Fairview in 1984. Exactly. Was killed, beaten
in Fairview.
Killed,
Park, remember it, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the idea now that that would happen is just an abhorrence to us.
That wouldn't have been a hate crime back then, but I think it's a hate crime now, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's certainly a hate crime now, you know.
Yeah. But at that time, it was used as a defence in court.
Yeah,
and it was an acceptable defence as well, and you had to
because he was gay.
You had to argue that.
But what Colm O'Gorman also says, and I think this is something that does need to be addressed, is it's all very well having a parade and having the pubs full and having people in good humour and everything else. But he says quite clearly, it would be foolish to be complacent and believe that the referendum will sail through. It will not.
No, we don't.
And he's saying that, but he's saying quite rightly. He said there are people who have concerns that must be heard and answered. The changing our constitution, especially in an area such as marriage and family, is something Irish people take seriously.
Very seriously, right? Yeah. We've seen that in the past.
Yeah, so I mean, if I don't know when the current government are going to have the referendum. They say they're going to have it over the next year. But I don't believe that the gay community should take it for granted that it's actually going to pass.
I also don't think we should take for granted that we are free from homophobia. I mean, you refer to that 1984 attack in the Fairview Park. Yeah. Those kinds of attacks, albeit not as severe maybe, happen all the time. And there are people who are constantly harassed and bullied. And you know, you see it from Panty Bliss's speech on the Abbey stage.
But I do think there's a significant difference in that. I remember back then there was what was called gay bashing. Mm. But it just wasn't reported because a gay man wouldn't go to police station.
But there's no point, you'd probably end up getting arrested.
But still,
in our schools, if Mary Hannafin decides to go back teaching and her lifestyle, she revealed, I'm not talking about you, Mary, personally, I'll talk about Jerry Buttermer, TD, John Lyons, two great TDs, both of them spoke at the Dáil recently about being teachers and about being gay, but they're both of them are teachers. If they went back, if the school decided that their lifestyle
conflicted with the ethos of that school, even though that school is paid for, every teacher in that school
state.
Is paid for by
it's
the taxpayer.
Part of the legislation,
they
yeah.
could, they, that is still in the legislation.
It is, yeah.
They can be
yeah.
told your job is no longer available. Why? Are you a brutal teacher? No. Are you? Have you stolen money? No. Have you committed a crime? No. It's because you have said publicly that you were gay. And that still exists in our legislation. That's
you've seen,
or not.
Joe, on a live line, you've seen it go from... I can going back the years, calls coming in of people who secretly were whispering nearly on the phone to you that they were gay, to a more in, are we a more enlightened?
Oh, I think so. I absolutely. Apart from those instances I just raised there, I think absolutely. Yeah, I think in fairness, Colin makes that point today, in his piece that we've come an awful long way.
He's, have we come far enough for the referendum?
He's got young children. He spoke about people who maybe were 22, 23 on yesterday's Rainbow March. It was a fantastic day as well, weather-wise. He said, like, going back to what happened in Fairview in 1993, which is relatively recently, when Declan was kicked to death. And the sentence doled out to those people was fairly lenient. Going back to what happened to Eileen Flynn, by the way, the teacher from New Ross, who in the 1980s was sacked because this woman became pregnant and the nuns discovered that she wasn't married. Unbelievable stuff. And but the most unbelievable element of it is that when she went to the Employment Appeals Tribunal, when she went to the High Court, and when she went to the Supreme Court, and indeed didn't get a lot of support in the Dáil, when she went to those three, if not four, state institutions, she got no help whatsoever. They upheld the decision of the nuns to sack a good teacher because she was pregnant. Believe it or not, and that happened in my lifetime. And anyone in that parade yesterday who was 30 will have been born in a country where that was tolerated.
My grandchildren will think we lived on the Planet of the Apes at that stage. Jerry, you were going to say something.
Yeah, no, I was just saying.
You've been best man at a couple of gay weddings. I saw that.
Yeah, last week, two great friends. Well, I'm just thinking. Also, I don't know if you agree, Roy. The awareness is a great thing to have. I mean, there was 200 or 300 guests. Michael and Jonathan, who were very good friends of mine, went through a wonderful silver ceremony last week in Cork, and I was best man, and Lisa was the best lady. And there was about, I'd say there must have been up to 300 people there, and everybody there, whatever views they had going in. I don't know. I'm very liberated in this area and I'm all for it. Yeah. I went to the Gay Pride, the Pride Parade last year, actually. Yeah. But I'd say the amount of people that went this year to that ceremony, I'd say all came out saying, super day, great occasion, you know, and let's move on.
Once
you
people
know,
are aware, you know, like people are fine with it. I don't know what the problem is. It's probably just legislation, but people themselves are fine. Like, I know for myself, with Mrs. Brown's boys, people come up and they love the character Rory, and there's older women that love me, and I always say, what's the story these older women want to try and kiss me and hug me and stuff like that? And I've been told that they love that character Rory, and if they had a gay son, they would like him to be like Rory Brown. And that all mothers and fathers just want their children to be happy.
That's it.
That's what they want.
Yeah.
And if their child is happy with another man or with another woman or whatever it is, that's the way... People are people. They're fine.
When it comes to a constitutional referendum, as Colin was saying this morning, all the issues then will come to light, which will be about
the threat to the family, the
issues of children, issues of adoption. I mean, these are real concerns, and I mean the point that he's making that they have to be addressed. Don't just take it as a colourful rainbow day parade.
Yeah.
We're all
it's not
kind
that.
Of happy,
no.
and everybody supports us.
And that's what I mean. It's going to
issues.
Take a long time for this thing. Like when we hear there's a referendum next year, I don't believe it's going to be next year. I think it'll be fobbed off the year after, the year after, the year after, and maybe in 5 years' time we'll still be talking about this, even though we shouldn't be.
No, we shouldn't be. And the important thing for me is that even if there isn't a referendum next year, and it may not be, we're talking about a referendum next year, and I can go back to 5, 6 years ago, 10 years ago certainly, we weren't even thinking about a referendum.
Though in fairness to the minister, who's no longer here, and he didn't leave in high dudgeon, but on the social issues, the Labour Party have been very good. They were very good on legislation for legislating through Alex White for the X case, and he points that out as one of his major achievements. They were very, very strong at that, against intense opposition. You know, people left Finnegan, ministers resigned, and other TDs threatened to revolt. The Labour Party pushed it through. The referendum is another project the Labour Party are
behind, yes, from Eamon Gilmore to Alex White to Joan Borton to Pat Rabbit. And I think it will happen. I think it will happen. And it will not be easy. It will not be easy, but it will happen.
I think we all hope. But I mean, why shouldn't the Labour Party be behind them? Because as long as I've been...
Because I'll tell you why, Brendan.
Because they're in a civil rights, Joe.
They're in a coalition government, whether you... The Labour Party did not win the last election.
No.
They got 20% of the vote. They're now down to 7%.
I know
that. They now have the numbers to make up a government. You know, people voted for other parties. I do, and I
knew going into that coalition, and I'm sure that you know, Fine Gael would make all the bad decisions and Labour would end up defending them, and that's even worse than making them. Look, we're going to take a break and then we come back and we talk a little bit more.